The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Good morning. I'm Vic McCunis, and this is the Best of the Book Nook. Tony Horwitz died a couple months ago, and I'm really missing him. We're going to bring you my 2003 interview with Tony Horwitz for his book, Blue Latitudes, on the Best of the Book Nook.
Good things come to those who wait. We have tracked down the elusive international correspondent Tony Horwitz. He's somewhere in an automobile near, is it Middletown?
I think. I'm completely lost, but somewhere between Cincinnati and Dayton, yes.
Tony, I'm so glad to get you on the phone. Your new book, Blue Latitudes, has just come out in paperback, boldly going where Captain Cook has gone before. The last time we had you on the program was for Confederates in the Attic, which I was just wild about, and I thought there's no way Tony can top that book. Well, I like them both equally. They're tremendous books. Tell us how you got the idea to follow Captain Cook's journeys.
Well, it really began 20 years ago when I fell in love with an Australian, my wife, Geraldine Brooks, and followed her to Australia. And being a bit of a history nerd, I picked up Captain Cook's journals one day to learn about the early European exploration of Australia, and I couldn't put them down. It was just the best historical adventure I'd ever read, sort of Lewis and Clark by, you know, sea instead of land, with cannibalism and orgies in Tahiti and all this good stuff they didn't teach us about in school.
And you went out and you basically followed major portions of his journey. He had three main voyages, didn't he?
Right. Three great Pacific voyages over a course of 10 years. On the first, he went to Tahiti and Bora Bora, Australia and New Zealand, most of that area entirely unknown to Europeans. On the second voyage, he was the first navigator to pierce the Antarctic Circle and circumnavigated Antarctica. And on the third voyage, he went in search of the Northwest Passage between the Pacific and Atlantic and went up as far as the Bering Sea in Alaska before returning to Hawaii, where he was killed.
He actually, quote, discovered Hawaii, end quote. Didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, we always have to use that word advisedly because, of course, there had been Polynesians there for hundreds of years. So I think all we can say is he was the first European that we know of to reach Hawaii. Up to that point, it was simply unknown to the West, and Hawaiians themselves, of course, had had no contact with Europeans. So it's this wonderful moment of first contact between really alien cultures. And this is an experience that Cook has over and over again, and one that we simply can't have today, you know, and that's why I used the sort of Star Trek joke in the subtitle. In a sense, Cook was doing what Captain Kirk did on the Starship Enterprise, beaming down to planets and encountering strange new worlds, and I think that's largely what drew me to the story.
But unlike Captain Kirk, he wasn't following that, what did they call it, where they didn't tamper with the worlds? You know what I'm talking about.
Prime directive.
Yeah, right.
Well, actually, in a way, they did. The notion was, or at least Cook's orders were, to treat the natives gently and make peace, et cetera. The problem is, just by the mere act of arriving, Cook and those who followed utterly transformed these societies, usually for the worse, the main cause being disease. So I think there was tremendous damage done, but it was mostly unintentional and mostly in Cook's wake, not done by Cook himself. We like to kind of blame these the first ones to get there. They're convenient symbols, whether it's Columbus or Cook. But in fact, you know, 100 men in a 100-foot ship couldn't do that much damage even if they had tried to. And in fact, for the most part, they were humane.
You were very fortunate that you had a sidekick on a lot of this. This Aussie, or this guy from Yorkshire, or wherever he's from, this guy's really a funny guy.
Roger Williamson. Yeah, I didn't plan to take on crew when I began this book, but I based myself in Sydney, which is has the best Cook archives and is a better jumping off point for the Pacific than my home in Virginia. And I hooked up with Roger, an old friend of mine from when I'd lived in Australia before, and he sort of barged into my story. He said, "I'm coming along." He's originally from Yorkshire, as Cook was. He's a great sailor, as Cook was. But he's also this sort of Falstaff character, a big, handsome guy who kind of loves wine, women, and song, and a good laugh. Among other things, he felt that we should be true to the history by drinking as much as Cook and his men, which was a considerable amount, given that the ration on 18th-century ships was a gallon of beer a day. And I guess I hope Roger, you know, adds some light relief to the story.
He's great. He's sort of your Stephen Katz.
You mean the guy from Bill Bryson's Walk in the Woods?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some of that. He's a bit of a moaner. He complains a bit. But he's, you know, he's a funny guy who tends to see the light and absurd side of things. And I'm kind of the straight guy in the book, I guess, compared to him.
You spent a lot of time in some very unusual places, and one that really stuck with me was this island, is it N-I-U-E?
Yeah, Niue.
Niue.
Right. This is a place that Cook called Savage Island because he was driven off by red-teethed savages, as he called them, with spears and stones. So he kind of just sailed away and said this awful place and called it Savage Island. I found out that it's now known as Niue, the smallest self-governing state in the world. And I decided just sort of to shake things up a bit and experience a bit of that Cook-like sense of discovery to simply go there without finding anything out about the place other than booking a plane ticket. I purposely avoided learning anything about it. I hadn't heard of it in the first place. I thought, well, this will be interesting. So Roger and I went there and indeed had this a very strange adventure trying to unlock the mystery of why these warriors had red teeth.
the banana and, mystery.
It was a somewhat comic mystery involving a red banana, and I won't give it away for readers who haven't read it, except to say that by the time Roger and I left the island, we were the least popular visitors to Niue since Cook himself, I think.
That was almost a detective portion of the book there where you were trying to figure that out.
Well, a detective, and also, well, particularly we ended up hijacking the police minister's car at one point, so it turned into a rather madcap sort of Keystone Cops detective work, I guess. But in the end, I think we did get to the bottom of the mystery of these red-teeth savages, as Cook called them, and whether they were cannibals or not. In my last book, Confederates in the Attic, I became a hardcore Civil War reenactor to understand a little bit about what it was like to be a soldier. And I thought that was the worst thing I'd ever do for the sake of book research. But frankly, I'd rather a spoon with smelly Confederates and gnaw on hardtack and salt pork than go back on the replica endeavor. I think what was most horrible for me was that I was assigned a main mast, which is 127 feet tall. And height radically amplifies the motion of a ship at sea. So when you're up there, clinging to the topmost spar, it's like being at the top of a tree that someone's trying to shake you out of. And then you have to start working. So if you combine a tendency toward seasickness with something of a fear of heights and a total inability to tie knots, it makes for a pretty ugly combination up there on top of the mast.
My guest is Tony Horowitz. The book is Blue Latitudes. A listener who is really devoted to this program called me when he heard that I'd booked this interview a couple months ago, and he said, "Vic, you're going to have to get yourself a nail to use as a bookmark." And it took me a little while to figure out what he meant, but I certainly got it. Nails are quite significant on some of these voyages, aren't they?
Well, yeah, and it's sort of awkward in some ways for us to talk about it today, but sex is a big and inescapable part of Cook's story. They sail 8 months from London to Tahiti, fed awful food, lashed for disobedience. The only females on board are a milk goat and one of the botanist's dogs. And they arrive at Tahiti where there are these beautiful women naked on the shore beckoning them to come in from their boats with what one sailor called every lewd gesture imaginable. And at that time, metal was unknown in Polynesia, and islanders immediately saw the value of it, that you could turn a nail into a fish hook. So the going rate for a woman's company was a single ship's nail, and this created a terrible problem for Cook and other commanders arriving at Tahiti, because the men were pulling so many nails from the ships that they literally began to fall apart.
My guest is Tony Horowitz. By the time Cook goes on his third and ultimately his final voyage, his behavior started changing a little bit, and you look at possibly some health problems he might have been having, and he really started reacting differently, didn't he?
Yeah, he seems to have fallen apart on this third voyage. This man who's totally in control on the first two voyages, a good commander, and for the most part a fair one, both towards his own people and native people, undergoes almost a complete personality change on the last voyage. He makes mistakes on his charts, which for Cook is like, you know, Einstein fumbling with his arithmetic. This was one of the greatest chart makers of all times, and here he is making mistakes. He becomes irrational and cruel, and at the end he really brings on his own death by provoking a needless skirmish in Hawaii. It's one of the many mysteries of Cook's story of exactly what went wrong. I discuss some of the various possibilities in the book, from possible drug addiction to various physical problems to simple burnout. And, you know, we can't answer it conclusively, partly because the last month of Cook's journal mysteriously disappeared. And that's another intriguing question, whether he simply stopped writing or whether what he wrote was so damning either to himself or the Navy that someone saw to it that it was destroyed after his death.
You're so thorough. You even went back to Yorkshire and looked at the roots of Cook.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I thought it was important to understand where this man came from. And one of the really most startling things about Cook is that this man who explored more of the Earth's surface than anyone in history came from the most pinched provincial background imaginable. He was the son of a day laborer, about as close as you could get to the bottom of British society in the 18th century. He was born in a mud and thatch cottage. I visited the site of it in a sort of damp, dreary town in northern Yorkshire. He had almost no formal schooling, and I visited the building where he was educated. And you know, seeing these places and how kind of cold and wet and cramped and isolated they were, and then that he went on to sort of, you know, these tropical paradises in the Pacific. I mean, he really went further than any other man, not just geographically, but just in terms of the leap he made, also, of course, becoming a captain and one of the most famous men of his day from this very deprived background. He really was a prodigy, almost a Mozart, one of these sort of self-created people who just bursts out of nowhere to do what he does.
I love following the maps that you have in the book and following the journey as you do around Australia and to places like New Zealand and the adventures that this man had. It's a stunning, stunning thing to even conceive of what he experienced with his crew.
Well, again, to me, there's, of course, yeah, the geographical story of just simply sailing off the edge of the known map over and over again. But I guess I'm most intrigued by the human part of the story, again, of these encounters with Maori and Aborigines in Australia and other peoples who had never encountered Europeans before, and this sort of wonderful moment of first contact. And as strange as this must have been for Cook and his men, for those they encountered, it must, you know, must have been so bizarre that we can't even really comprehend it today. It would be like you know, an alien spacecraft touching down in your backyard in Ohio and little green men stepping out to greet you, except that Hollywood has, you know, prepared us even for that. You know, for Maori and Aborigines and others, they had no basis for you know, imagining pale men in tall ships speaking an unfamiliar tongue simply appearing over the horizon. And there are these wonderful stories that I include in the book about how they saw the first Europeans.
And James Cook also went really far north and really far south.
Yep, he went over to about 70 degrees south and north. Again, incredibly, in a wooden ship with no real preparation for ice. The men had, you know, wool jackets, but you know, were up there on the mast battling frostbite as well as a dysentery, incipient scurvy, what they called bursted bellies, which were hernias, if you can imagine doing this heavy labor for 3 years with a hernia. 40% of Cook's men die on his first voyage, which I think gives some indication of how hazardous this was. And it, you know, it kind of put my own occasional griping in perspective. We've gone awfully soft by comparison, and anyone who does anything out of the ordinary today is a hero or a survivor. None of us could endure a month of what Cook and his men put up with for 3 years at a time.
We really are so delighted that we could spend a few moments with you.
Well, likewise. Thanks for having me.
And Tony, aren't you trying to come up with that next idea? I know when you decide to write a book, it's a pretty big commitment. What are you considering?
I've actually, two things. I've just finished an anthology called The Devil May Care, which has just come out, and it's a series of great stories of travel and exploration from America that I think most of us don't know. And now I've just embarked on a new book about early exploration of America. It's sort of a follow-up to the cookbook. I realized that I know very little about the comparable story of first contact in America, except for the little I learned in school about Columbus and a few other figures. So I'm going to try and fill in that a blank in my own knowledge and perhaps readers by writing about kind of Vikings to Mayflower.
That was Tony Horwitz, recorded in 2003 for the Best of the Book Nook, talking about his book Blue Latitudes. Tony died a couple months ago, and his new book, Spying on the South, I think is the best thing he's ever written. Coming up following this next break, we're going to bring you part of an interview I did with a woman who was married, Tony Horwitz. Her name is Geraldine Brooks. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, as I remember Tony Horwitz. And up next, I'm going to bring you an interview I did with his wife, Geraldine Brooks, in 2002 for her book Year of Wonders, a novel of the plague. And during this excerpt, she talks about how she met Tony. Geraldine, this book is a result of your hearing about a real village. Tell us the story of where the germination happened with this idea that turned into a book.
I was working at the time as Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, and we were based in London. And in between my assignments in all those hot, troubled places, I used to come home, and my husband and I used to love to walk in the English countryside. It was one of those walks in the Peak District of England. I saw a sign saying Plague Village. And I don't know about you, but to me, tales of disease are better than 1,001 nights, and there was no way that I wasn't going to go there and find out what that was all about. And so I stumbled into the village, which is called Eme, quite by chance, and there in the church was set out the story of what had happened when bubonic plague came there in 1666, and the village took a unique decision to quarantine itself so that people wouldn't, in fleeing from the village, spread the infection throughout surrounding communities.
And that was rather unusual, was it not?
It was unique. Mm. There were quarantines as a result of plague or Black Death, but they were always imposed from outside on an unwilling population. This is the only group of people that ever took the heroic and self-sacrificing step of voluntarily quarantining themselves.
Now, how did this real fact turn into fiction?
Well, I didn't run back home to my garret and quit my job and start writing a novel. It took a number of years. I went on working as a reporter and covering modern catastrophes in Africa and the Middle East. But in the middle of doing that work, I'd often think about Eme and wonder what had really happened there during that year. How the people had reached the decision they'd taken and how they'd lived with the consequences of it. And I guess that it might have just stayed something that I chewed on. if it hadn't been for the Nigerian secret police who in 1991 threw me in the slammer for a few days. And while I was lying there on the concrete floor, I had time to reflect on the fact that I didn't know how long they were going to keep me. And if they kept me too long, I'd probably be too old to have a child. So when they actually did release and deport me after 3 days, I ran home to my husband, Tony, and said, you know, we're getting pretty long in the tooth here. We better think about having a family. And luckily for me, our son was born the following year. But I had to find a new line of work because I couldn't continue being a foreign correspondent who went to dangerous assignments.
And sadly, it's gotten to be an even more dangerous job.
Certainly has, in the aftermath of the unspeakable execution of Danny Pearl. I'm very glad I'm not in that line of work anymore.
You really drew me in as I read this book. Tell us about your protagonist.
The voice of the book is a young woman named Anna. And she was suggested to me by just half a line in a letter that the real rector of Eam wrote during this year of plague. And it's a very sad letter. He's writing after his wife has died, and he just makes passing reference to his maid. He said, "Fortunately, my maid continued in health, which was a blessing, for had she quailed, I should have been ill set." And I read that, and I then tried to find out if anything was known about who this maid was. And nothing. There was nothing on the record. This was a village of mainly illiterate people, lead miners and sheep farmers. So the written record of that year is very scant. And so I was free to make her up. And I made her up as a young widow of a lead miner with two small children, who works in the rectory part of the time and keeps sheep part of the time. So she's somebody who's very much part of the village life, but she has an eye on what the gentry are up to. So she's the perfect person to tell the story through. And she changes a lot in the course of the book, and I think I had the courage to allow her to do that based on some real women that I'd met when I was reporting in the Middle East. Women who'd led very circumscribed lives until a great crisis in their community had forced them to step out of their home and out of their expectations and take new roles. And I'd seen women do that and change enormously and become incredibly strong in the face of crisis. So that's what happens to Anna.
Now, I haven't read your earlier work. Didn't you write a book that looked at these kinds of women?
At Muslim women, yes. It's that book was called Nine Parts of Desire.
My guest is Geraldine Brooks. Her book is Year of Wonders. As the book opens, we have this woman, and she's just become a widow. And her husband was a lead miner. Now, I had never even heard of lead mining. I'd never even thought, where does lead come from? Clearly, you had to do some research to really comprehend this particular aspect of, was it Derbyshire?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've got books on my shelves that I never expected to own, like huge tomes, history of lead mining in the Pennines. But it is actually a fascinating little subculture. I mean, England is very rich in these medieval guilds and so forth, but the lead miners had an extraordinary world of their own, code of laws. Basically, anyone was free to go onto anybody's land and make a claim, stake a claim to mine lead. And if they were successful within a certain number of weeks, that mine was theirs as long as they could keep it producing. And we get a lot of idiom from lead mining that I had never realized. Like when you say he nicked that, meaning he stole it, this comes from the lead mining culture where if somebody didn't get a dish of lead, a certain quantity of lead out of their claim in a certain time, another miner or would-be miner could come and put a nick or a cut on the wooden stoves that supported the mine. And if they got three nicks in a certain number of weeks up on the stoves, they could take the claim. So they nicked the claim, and that's where that word comes from.
And I also got the impression that you could just go on to someone else's land and just stake a claim.
So long as you did it the right way, and it was very prescribed. You had to have a certain number of wooden beams, and you had to lay them this way and that way. And you could, yes. And the thinking behind that was that lead was necessary for all kinds of things, for building, for, you know, making roofs watertight, for making the lead glass windows in churches, and then later, of course, for military purposes. So it was in the country's interest to have a lot of people mining lead. And so this was one way that you could encourage that.
And, of course, it was very dangerous, like probably any job was back in 1666. And 1666 was a particularly bad year in England, wasn't it?
Very eventful year. And I had known from my freshman college days the Dryden poem, Year of Wonders, Annus Mirabilis. And I thought, why would you call a year when you had the plague, the Great Fire of London, the war with the Dutch? Why would this be a year of wonders? And yet, as you read the poem, it becomes clear that Dryden sees it that way because it has brought out the essential character of the British people in adversity. They have triumphed over all these terrible scourges. And I guess that, you know, when I set out to write a book set in 1666, I didn't think it would have any contemporary resonance, but it has had some.
You're referring to last year?
Yeah, I think the way a society responds to a crisis it depends which way they go, whether it brings out the heroism and the generosity of spirit, or whether it brings out the urge to turn on and blame the other, whoever that's conceived to be. I guess depends whether it will ultimately be seen as a year of wonders for us or not.
I see this book, Year of Wonders, as a story of healing. We have the plague, which I think most of us really can't even wrap our minds around anymore. We would have a difficult time comprehending living in a world like this, and the devastation, physical, emotional, spiritual, that happens in this little community. People go crazy. It's incredible. You have a scene where a woman is accused of being a witch. And this is just so out of control and so powerful, and there's so much emotion and craziness going on. And a modern reader reading this says, oh my, you know, you can't even get your mind around living in this kind of a time.
It's a fascinating time, Vic, because it's two things at once. You've got the medieval superstition is still there, particularly in the rural areas, and witch trials were being conducted in rural England at this time. At the same time, you have the restoration spirit, and a kind of a modern sensibility is emerging. It's really the cusp of the modern era. At the same time as the superstition, you have Isaac Newton doing the experiments that are laying the foundation of modern scientific thought. So it's like the modern world is there and people are reaching out for it, but medievalism is still grabbing at their heels. And the people of Eme have been through so much change. They've seen every certainty overturned. They've seen regicide. They've seen a king killed. They've seen their church toppled and a new kind of worship put in its place, and then that's been booted out. And then comes the plague, which is something that they don't understand. They don't know what it is. We know it's bacteria and that it is spread from rat fleas to human beings. They had no idea how it was conveyed from one person to another. It's a time of faith, but it's a time of faith that's been questioned and challenged. So that, to me, made it a fascinating time to imagine and to write about.
And they couldn't have known the cure was Marmite, or if you're in Australia, Vegemite. I'd like to share with our listeners the fact that your husband has actually been on this program as well and wrote one of my favorite books from a couple years ago. He sat right there at that same spot.
And loved every minute of it, said it was the best interview he ever had.
I loved his book, and he's a great interview. In fact, we had him on twice for the same book. It's Confederates in the Attic. His name is Tony Horowitz. Now, I know he has the same kind of background as you, and I want to know how you met.
Well, very unmysteriously, we met at Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. And he had been working as a labor organizer with a woodcutters union in Mississippi. And I'd been working on a newspaper in Sydney, Australia. So our paths crossed in New York City.
See, I was picturing you like in Bosnia or someplace like this. Now, did you shadow each other when you were working?
We dragged each other around the world, yes. Well, our romance blossomed, actually, not in New York, but in Cleveland and Fort Wayne. He was working on the News Sentinel, and I was working for the Journal in Cleveland. And we used to commute every weekend. We'd take it in turns, and it was always snowing. Or at least in my memory, it was.
He was in Fort Wayne?
Yep.
Wow.
And then I dragged him to Australia, and then we both went off to the Middle East. And then he got a job with the Journal in England, and it started off as pretty hardcore, covering the walls coming down in east and west. And then it got more leisurely, and I was still going out to the Middle East and Africa and covering catastrophes, and he was basically tooling around England, writing hard-hitting pieces on why so many towns had silly names like Great Snoring.
That's a page out of the Bill Bryson book there. He did that same kind of thing in one of his books about England.
Right.
How does a woman from Australia end up at Columbia?
I was lucky enough to get a scholarship that was created in memory of a news correspondent, an Australian, who was killed when the Indonesian army invaded East Timor.
Oh.
And he had always had a dream to go and do his master's at Columbia. So after his death, his wife got up a scholarship in his memory. His name was Greg Shackleton. So I was the first beneficiary of that.
Well, we've actually had Jose Ramos Horta on this program.
I see.
You said East Timor. I was like, whoa. we're following a circuitous path. I don't know where we're going. My guest is Geraldine Brooks. The book is Year of Wonders, a novel of the plague. Why were you arrested in Nigeria? What were you doing?
Oh, that was a terrible story I was covering for the Wall Street Journal, basically about how Shell Oil was in cahoots with the Nigerian government to bring in the military to suppress a totally nonviolent movement of extremely poor subsistence farmers whose land had been absolutely despoiled for 35 years. And,
was this before or after Ken Saro-Wiwa?
Ken Saro-Wiwa had come to New York to talk to the foreign editor about what was going on. And frankly, when I heard the story, I didn't buy it. I just thought no multinational company would behave like that in this day and age. But my wonderful foreign editor at the time said, go and check it out. And so I did. And I got there, and it was worse than anything Ken had said. It was just, I got there right in the wake of an army operation. And I have to just say how poor these people are. It was naked children, people drawing water from wells that were totally contaminated by oil spills that had lain on the ground for 20 years and not been addressed. Gas pipelines running right up hard against thatched huts, and terrible fires had ensued, and Shell had done nothing for the people. There wasn't one functioning school. There was no medical care to speak of. And when they had a sit-in to protest this, Shell had asked the army to come in and clean it up. So that was what I saw. And I talked to Ken, and I went around and had a look at all these terrible things. And then I, like a good journalist, went to the military to say, what's your side of the story? And they handed me over to the secret police and accused me of being a French spy.
French?
Well, that's what I said. I said, you wouldn't think that if you heard me speak French. But they didn't get the joke.
How convenient. Well, Ken's son has a book out, and he was scheduled to be on this program last September 18th.
Oh.
And we had to cancel, and I've never been able to get him back.
Oh.
But it's a book apparently about this.
Well, Ken Saro-Wiwa, as you know, was executed a year after I was there. And over the protests of the civilized world. And even though, When the story came out about what was going on, there was an enormous internal protest within Shell because there are many good people working in that company who were appalled to think that this had been happening, and there has been reform. But at the time of Ken's arrest on trumped-up charges and at the time of his execution, Shell did not intervene in a meaningful way, and they were the one party that would have had the clout to have stopped it.
So you actually met him?
Oh, yeah.
What was he like?
He was lovely. He was a pipe-smoking intellectual, a very good man. I don't think that I've met people who are prepared to die for their cause. People like the Kurdish Peshmerga, who actually call themselves We Who Face Death, and they do. I think Ken was so confident in the essential justice of what he was asking for, which was not much, just a fair share for the people of this region of Nigeria, just basic decency, health and education for the children, and a share of the oil wealth that was, after all, coming out of their land. I don't think he had any idea that he was going to be required to pay for this with his life. I think he would have gone into exile in London, where he spent a great deal of time. But the government was just more ruthless, I think, than he had imagined.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Geraldine Brooks. Her book is Year of Wonders, A Novel of the Plague. And you're probably saying, well, why are you talking about Nigeria? We tend to go wherever the road takes us. And now we're going to another place. What's a bubo?
A bubo is the plague swelling. What it is an inflamed lymph node. So what happens when you get bitten by a flea who has bitten an infected rat, the bacteria in the flea's gut gets transferred to your bloodstream, and it sets up a massive infection. The bacteria multiplies within hours, invades the lymph nodes, and they swell and basically burst out of the skin. They're in your neck and in your groin primarily, so that's where the swelling rises. And then the body just starts to break down under the weight of this infection. And the next symptom is, we've all said the nursery rhyme, ring a ring of roses, a pocket full of posies.
Is that where that comes from?
The ring of roses is necrotic tissue that bursts up under the surface of the skin. And it looks like red rose petals at first, and then it turns black. That's why it's called the Black Death. The pocket full of posies refers to the fact that people thought that plague was something in the air, and that if you had fresh herbs and could breathe through them, you could safeguard yourself from infection. And that's why the plague doctors used to wear those bird-like beak masks that you might have seen in old etchings. They would stuff the beak full of herbs and breathe through that. Of course, that had nothing to do with it. Tissue, we all fall down. That the sneezing is if the infection goes to your lungs and becomes pneumonic, you will sneeze uncontrollably, and all fall down, of course, is the sudden death. So it's not so much fun to hear that nursery rhyme once you know all that.
Well, it's funny. I hadn't even thought of that rhyme in years, and I have memories of hearing it, and we all think it's this wonderful, sweet nursery rhyme, but there was always something a little eerie about it, I thought, as a kid.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were absolutely damn straight.
I think it was the part, all fall down. You know, it was like Village of the Damned.
Right.
You know, the kids with the wide eyeballs. I know you've seen those films. Cheap British horror films. You know which ones I'm talking about?
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. One of my personal favorites, in fact.
My guest is Geraldine Brooks. Her book is Year of Wonders, A Novel of the Plague. What's it like when you go to a book signing? What happens? Do you read from the book? Do you answer?
I usually read very little. I usually just talk. And I like to talk for a while and then get pretty quickly to the questions, because it's when you get into the dialogue with the people who come that you can communicate best on the level of interests that you both share, instead of just me saying. And occasionally I will read briefly. I think it's hard to listen to long readings unless the reader is absolutely somebody like Charles Frazier, whose accent is so gorgeous I could listen to it all day.
What is the really obvious question that nobody ever asks you?
I'll tell you the question that they always do ask. People, even though it's fiction, everybody seems to like it better the closer it hews to the truth. And at first I was very prepared to support this and would tell people exactly what was true and what wasn't, because I like to know that too. But after a while, as you know, and I'm now working on my second historical novel, and I started to think, well, hell, you know, this is a novel. I can make it up if I want to. So now I tend to get a little bit ornery. And when people say, well, the ending, she couldn't have possibly have done that. And the truth is, I actually looked into many things to find out if that was possible and found a true story that's even more extraordinary than the one that happens to Anna, and based what happens to her very closely on that. But the orneriness in me now is saying, well, too bad.
That's very funny. I like that. Well, it's really been a pleasure having you on the program.
Well, Vic, it's been a delight to be here.
What's the theme of that book you're working on?
It's based on the true story of a Hebrew manuscript that was created in Muslim Spain in the 1300s and still exists today.
For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Give my best to Tony.
I sure will, Vic.
That was Geraldine Brooks, recorded in 2002, talking about her novel Year of Wonders, a novel of the plague, and also talking about her husband, Tony Horwitz, who died recently, as we remember him on the Best of the Book Nook. And coming up following this break, a Best of the Book Nook bonus. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. It's 1958, and we have a Best of the Book Nook bonus for you this morning. We remembered Tony Horwitz during the first part of the program, and now looking back in an interview I did with Art Buchwald, who was one of the best-known newspaper columnists of the 20th century. He died in 2007, and I interviewed him once. He was coming to town to talk about Irma Bombeck. Let's listen now to Art Buchwald. You and Irma had columns in the same papers for all those years.
Yeah.
You're still writing your column, aren't you?
I'm still writing my column.
I understand you've relocated, though. You're not in D.C. anymore after so many years.
Yeah, I moved to New York. I got bored with Washington.
Art, you have been doing this for a number of years,
yeah.
And you've been chosen to give the keynote address at the Irma Bombeck Conference on American Humor. What are you going to talk about in your address?
Humor.
Uh-huh.
Irma, humor, anything that will get me off the hook. By the way, you want a good story about Dayton?
Yeah.
Well, one time I was there years ago, Barry Goldwater was then running for president of the United States, and in Dayton, we split it one afternoon and one morning for the women's conference. It was a lecture series, and I had made a remark on radio, could have been your radio, about Barry Goldwater. And about an hour later, they got a call at the radio station, said they were going to shoot me the next morning. And so the women were very upset about this. And I said, they said, do you want to do it? And I said, well, I'll do it, but I'll take a very short bow. Now, the police was all over the place. And then as soon as my thing was over, they took me to the airport, the police chief, and then I picked up the paper a week later, the Dayton paper, and it said, Mr. Buckwell says this happens to him all the time. So now I'm returning to Dayton, and I hope nobody has any crazy ideas.
Now, was that back when Barry Goldwater was running for president?
Yeah.
Okay. Art, you spent a dozen years in Paris. Those must
14
have been,
years there.
That must have been wonderful.
Yeah, every part of my life has been wonderful because I was in the Marine Corps, and then I went to the USC, and then I went to Paris. So I can't say one was greater than the other, but that one was a real chapter in my life because that's where I got married and that's where I had children, and the memories of those days were so great. I mean, we'll never see anything like that again.
Now, Art, you grew up in Queens, and in 1942, you dropped out of high school to join the Marine Corps for a three-year service in the Pacific.
Yeah.
My dad did the same thing in 1942. He went out there and was on islands like Saipan. What was that like for you to be out there in the Pacific? Did you?
Well, it sounds like your dad was in the ground troops.
He was in the 2nd Division.
Yeah, well, that's pretty rough stuff. I was in the air wing, and all I did was clean guns and, you know, I didn't have that kind of experience, but Saipan was very rough, and the guys in the 2nd Division were very great, and I can't claim to be in the same class with the ground troops. But I didn't select the air. They selected me.
Uh-huh. Now, I remember a piece, I think in Playboy, that you wrote, gosh, I hate to say it's probably been 30 years ago, where you reminisce about you and a buddy who used to go out during the war and you would meet young ladies, and your buddy...
Dooley.
You remember...
Talking about Dooley.
Yeah,
Dooley used to go out, and he'd have so much luck with the women, and I didn't believe him, so I went out with him, and it turns out that the reason Dooley had all that luck is he told the women he couldn't make it with a woman, and they decided to make him into a man.
Well, I definitely remember that piece.
Yeah, well, it's remembered by a lot of people. They like the idea of what a way to be attractive is to tell someone you can't make it with them. I didn't do it.
Now, reminiscing again about Irma Bombeck, what do you recall about her that, besides her sense of humor, that really touched you?
Well, she laughed at all my jokes. And that was a very important thing, to have a friend who laughs at your jokes. Secondly, the touching part of it was that towards the end, when she was sick and she needed a kidney and all that stuff, she was a very, very brave woman. Very brave. And she never complained, and she never let on to anyone that she was hurting. And I knew the only thing that I could do for her was to make her laugh. And so I'd call her up and make her laugh. My favorite story was I took her to Dinah Shore's once, and Cary Grant was there. And Emma was crazy about Cary Grant. And when I took her home that night, she said, I accused her of sneaking her hotel key under Cary Grant's plate.
Hmm.
And she said to me, "So what?"
I think there was a piece in the paper here in Dayton over the weekend that had that anecdote in it, Art.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what's next for you. You're still writing your column. You've written a zillion books. Are you just kind of...
I don't know. Thanks for asking, but I have no idea. You know, I'm sitting in a nice hotel suite in New York, got lots of friends. I can still write. I'm just thinking of what I'm going to write next. I did a column, which I don't think I'm in Dayton anymore, but I used to be in Dayton in the paper. And it's about the bleeps in The Sopranos. Every other word is a bleep.
Uh-huh.
And then I decided to get away from them in Sopranos. So I went to the movie to see American Beauty, and everything was a bleep there. So the writers are using more bleeps than they've ever used before.
Are you saying that doesn't take much effort?
It's easy.
Uh-huh.
It's easy. And frankly, The Sopranos is a great show. I don't think it needs as many bleeps.
Uh-huh.
But who am I except a critic?
Yeah. Well, I remember reading your column about Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. You're still the wit of Washington. I don't care what they say.
Am I?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll take that. I'll take anything you give me. That was a pretty good story for a year. I mean, you can't, a newspaper person and even radio and everything else, you can't get mad when you got a good story, because suddenly the reader and the listener is with you and joining you in whatever it is. If it's very boring, as it is right now with Gore and Bush, it's kind of hard to get the reader or the listener too involved.
Well, we're bound to get some excitement sooner or later, let's hope, between Gore and Bush.
You sounded very plaintive when you said that.
That was the late Art Buchwald, who died in 2007. The day after he died, the New York Times posted a video obituary in which Art Buchwald said, "Hi, I'm Art Buchwald, and I just died." For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.